that my friends think back, and then covers an awful lot of territory, and more territory than I can begin to bring to you today. And what I hope to do is just for a few minutes, as Earl said, is to bring back to all of us names and places and happenings that memories are made of, and to many of us, memories are really, honestly, our most cherished possession. Some of us, in fact, live with our memories. And rather quickly, let me make the trip north from Seattle to Skagway. We arrived there in May of 1902. At that time, Dyeth, familiar to a few of you as the start of the Chilkoot Trail, it was a deserted town. Skagway, with its five docks and railroad to Whitehorse, completed in 1899, was the gateway to the Yukon. After a three-year stay in Skagway, journey was continued on to Fairbanks. By the way, I made that trip alone. I was put in the custody. I was, when was that, 1905? I had to be 12 years old at that time, I guess. I was put in the custody of a fine gentleman who was the commissioner of the Yukon. I was introduced to him, as I remember, down at the railroad depot that was on Broadway and Skagway at that time. And that's the last I saw him until we got off the boat in Dawson. I think he probably did a pretty good job of taking care of me at that. We both got there. The trip, of course, was to Whitehorse, then by boat down to Dawson and to Tanana, and then up to Chena. And this was in July of 1905. And the narrow gauge railroad from Chena to Fairbanks had just been completed. It was in operation just a few short weeks. Ties and rails were laid on top of the tundra, moss. There was no pretense made of ballast. And it was about the roughest up and down sideways trip that you could possibly imagine. Today we're paying tribute, and it has been paid already, to Felix Pedro, the discoverer of pay dirt and what came to be known as the Fairbanks Camp. And right now we are standing on Discovery Claim. This monument that we are standing alongside of, presumably and as much accuracy as is possible at this late date, is where the Discovery shaft was sunk, some 40 feet to bedrock. His discovery of gold and was later named Clary Creek. Discovery on Pedro and Goldstream, and by the way, Clary Creek was the first discovery that Pedro made, but it was of so little consequence in his opinion that he carried it no further. But it was recorded in Circle on September the 11th. But what we should like to talk about today is the others who became involved with Pedro in what has turned out to be the longest lived, prosperous, operating, continuing placer mining camp in the world. Most of them had their heyday within 3 or 4 or 5 years. Those that made it quit the country and saw no more of them. Those that didn't make it hunted for other camps. But think about men like Wickersham, the first federal judge that we had in this district. He was later a delegate to Congress from Alaska. Frank Clary, who at one time in the very, very early moments of the camp was a watchman for Barnett and his stock of goods down on the banks of the Chena. I believe Clary Creek was named after him. Fred Parker, Frank Noyes, Roy Rutherford, lumbermen who started mills to supply the fast-growing needs for lumber on the creeks and in town. While the mills is on Front Street, and when this carriage, salt carriage, moved back and forth, why, at one tour of its movement, it was stopping traffic on First Avenue. Imagine that if you can. And teams that were waiting there to pick up the lumber as it fell off of the saws, dripping wet. And they hauled it out to the creeks and they tacked up buildings out of it, used it for sluice boxes and what have you. And if you'd have been here 40 years ago, you could have seen the results of nailing up wet lumber. It leaves cracks as wide as the board was to start with. Clarence Berry and his brother. I wonder how many people here remember Clarence Berry. Made a fortune in the Klondike. Came down to Fairbanks. Esther Creek was hardly known. People hadn't even gone to Esther Creek. They were going out towards Goldstream, Fox, Gilmore, Clary Creek. He goes over on 7 Below on Esther Creek and makes another fortune, he and his brother. After they'd taken all the gold out of the creek that they could get, while they went down to California and made another fortune in oil. Just how lucky some people make it. And Dick Rothenberg, we all know him. In the later days, while he was secretary of the pioneer of the igloo here. And he was a man that grubstaked Felix Pedro on a number of occasions, not necessarily on the tour that brought Felix here, but he did stake him when Felix went into the Circle Country. Dan McCarty, he was a man that made a discovery over on Fairbanks Creek. And he later developed one of the first apparent lode mines at the head of that creek that there was in the camp. None of them ever turned out too good, but they sure made a try. Andrew Nearland, man who brought painting and paper hanging to Fairbanks, later on to Nenana. Tom Gilmore, Fanny and Joe Quigley. Gosh, I don't imagine there's a person in the group that didn't either know Fanny and Joe or at least had heard of them. I remember one time I was at dinner with Fanny was there, Joe wasn't, but Fanny was there, and they had served beef roast, and she took a couple of tastes of it, and she said, "Throw that damn stuff away." She said, "Got no taste to it." Been living off of moose meat half her life. Ed Stroker, he worked in the drift mines here in Fairbanks, and got his start there. I know him when he was a bookkeeper for E.R. Peoples up on, E.R. Peoples had a store where the Nordale Hotel is now. He later became president and owner of the First National Bank. Bob Sheldon, the pioneer in auto transportation. He was so much of a pioneer, he built his own automobile down in Skagway out of a bunch of old junk that had been thrown away, buckboards and what have you, and a little engine out of a fishing boat. He didn't know anything about differentials, so when he got up to a corner, well, he had to get out and lift the back end of it around so he could make a turn. Bob Broom, and we have just had the pleasure of introducing and welcoming his wife. Bob brought a pack into Dawson on his back and went into mercantile business later down in Fairbanks and developed in one of the real estate owners of Fairbanks. Posey Ross, and this list is just absolutely endless of names seldom seen in print, but who contributed mightily to Alaska and its welfare, and women by the score who backed up these men. I wouldn't dare start mentioning them. I'd sure leave out half of the most important ones, and then I'd beat my neck from here on out. The NC Company, I think, should come in for a lot of praise. They were early in the game here. They bought out Barnett stock. And at a time when there was very, very little money in the camp, people were broke. They'd come down from the upper country, and they'd spent what money they had getting here on their first grub stakes, and they'd gone for broke. And the NC Company extended credit to them to a point that was just fabulous. And their loss, as I have heard of late years, was just minuscule compared to the credit they extended to people they had no knowledge of whatsoever. They had mail routes, the first ones to put in horses between here and Valdez. They had dog team routes, and they had some dog team or mail carriers that were at least famous around here. I don't know how far their fame spread throughout the world. Windy Jim, the one, that's a good name, but he's first man, I believe, to carry petitions back to Congress seeking mail routes for the interior of Alaska, from the coast to the interior. Billy Burke, famous for his 28 dog teams. And I don't know whether Billy's still living or not, but I saw him in Nenana just a few years ago. I don't know.
I think he is.
Still living. Praise the Lord if he is. He's a wonderful guy. Leonard Sutler, who later made history of a source on his serum run to Nome, or his share in that serum run, but later became world famous for his dog teams and his dog racing. Another person that used to live up the street from me when we lived on Dunkel Street some years ago was Elam Harnish. Jack London made him famous by calling him Burning Daylight. To those of you that remember him, he was well named. He wasn't a big man, but boy, he was quick and on the move all the time. We had John Palm, Ed Bartlett, mail carriers on the Circle Run, and Ed Bartlett, the one I'm speaking of here, is the father of Bob Bartlett, and he carried mail on that Circle Run when, so help me, they'd leave town here and get this far out. Well, they didn't know whether they had a trail ahead of them or not. They'd go by the valleys rather than by trails. So anybody's guess where the trail was. Something that interest some of you here that are maybe newcomers, that when you came out here today, well, you had the choice of three bridges to get across the Chena Slough with, or the Chena River. I mean, out of Fairbanks. You go out to Fort Wayne right away, you got two or three more out there. Then there was one bridge. And this, as those of you that were here in those days, is for the birds. The bridges built on piling down to the foot of where Turner Street is now, and it would go out in the spring, completely out, and then the only transportation across the river was after the ice had gone out, was they'd put in two barges, one at the end, upstream end of Wendell, and the other one down at, oh, just about where the Chamber of Commerce building is now. They have these current-operated barges, charge you two bits to go across on. And new piling would be driven every year and be good for the summer, providing there was no high water, a lot of driftwood that would knock the bridge out. The narrow gauge was extended to Gilmore that year. You could go across in the ferry and pick up the narrow gauge, and you could go on out to Gilmore and save yourself a walk. It would take you to good. Gilmore Station is down there, a couple of miles downstream, the junction of Gilmore Creek and Pedro. And it was quite a little town at that time. In the beginning of the switch back up over the hills, it took the train from Gilmore, then over the hills and back to Dome and up to Chattanooga, And that was a godsend to everybody that had needed transportation to the creeks, because in those days, you couldn't afford a stage, and there wasn't much of a stage anyhow. And it was a day and a half hike. And for a poor walker and a good walker, could make it in a day. I made it one time to go out to Chattanooga to collect $5 from a guy that owed me, and I needed the money. I wouldn't walk half a mile probably now for $5, then I walked 24. then after the operation had gone on for some years to Chattanooga, from Chena to Fairbanks, and then on to Gilmore and on to Chattanooga. The railroad came to Nenana. Someday somebody's going to make a story of that, and it'll take up your time for an hour and a half. And it's a good story, too. But it got no further than Nenana. Either fun stopped or, for some reason or other, no bridge across the Tananaw. The wintertime they'd run the narrow gauge from Fairbanks to this bank of the Tananaw. In the wintertime they'd lay rails on the ice and run the trains across the Tananaw, and rail would almost meet rail on the other side, and it was an easy transfer of passengers and freight, and then come back into Fairbanks and narrow gauge. But in the year 1915, the official completion of the railroad was made. Then it was possible to go from Fairbanks to Seward, and from Seward on into Seattle, and with good connections you could make it in 7 days. Now even even with the airplanes canceling out, you can always make it in one day. It doesn't matter how many times you get canceled. You'll find some plane somewhere that's going, and when you do get on the plane, well, you can make it in 3 hours. That's quite a chore. From the early days of the camp, well, it was 8 days to by stage to Valdez, and 5 days or 6 days possibly to Valdez to Seattle. Providing you made connections, you could make her in 12 days. Now you can make it in 3 hours with just a wee bit of luck. Of course, it takes you quite a while to get to the airport and quite a ways of time to get away from it when you get to Seattle, but just the same, it all happens in one day. 1915, why President Harding arrived on the scene and drove a golden spike at Nenana that marked the completion of standard gauge transportation from Seward into Fairbanks. 1915 also made history when the cornerstone of the Alaska Agricultural and School of Mines was laid on the campus of what is now the University of Alaska. Now, these two events, to my way of thinking, are prophetic. They're loaded with prophecy. Golden Spike, I think we can very easily say to ourselves, ended our isolation from the outside world. That meant that we had transportation within the hands and grasp of any person, regardless of how little money you had, getting to the States the year round. Before, it was terrific getting out of Fairbanks and to the States. And the cornerstone laying surely tells us that there's a lot more to Alaska and a lot more in the interior of Alaska than the gold that we came here for in the early days. I think that that is the end of an era. That I would call it the end of an era, at least. Maybe some future speaker from this same position can take you from 1915 on. If that's the end of an era, let's make it the end of my talk. I think it's getting pretty near time for coffee.
Thank you, Forbes. You've got a very...
Yeah. And thank you very kindly. All my efforts.
You want to reel it back and listen to it?